I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is award-winning Israeli-American chef Michael Solomonoff. He's joined in conversation by Michael Bauer, executive food and wine editor and restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Michael Solomonoff and Michael Bauer.
Tonight, we are here, and you are here, to learn about Michael Solomonoff and Zahav, his wonderful, wonderful book. So I have to ask, how many of you have been totally seduced by Yotam Ottolenghi's recipes and books? Yes, that's right. All right. Well, you are in for a treat, because there's a new Israeli chef in town and cookbook author. Modern Israeli cooking was virtually unknown in the U.S. when Mike opened Zahav with his co-author and business partner, Stephen Cook, who's here tonight, in 2008. But it wasn't long before they were receiving rave reviews. Mike won a James Beard Award, and Mike and Steve's restaurant empire now includes Zahav, Federal Donuts, Dizengoff, Abe Fisher, and Percy Street Barbecue, all in Philadelphia. And according to Eater this morning, their empire will soon include a spot in New York City, which is very exciting. Our very own esteemed San Francisco Chronicle food writer and critic at large, Michael Bauer, in a piece discussing what he wished we had in San Francisco that other cities have, said, quote, "First thing I'd do if I had my way is to plunk Zahav down south of Market near my house." So the praise doesn't get much higher than that, folks. And since, as far as I know, that's not in the cards yet, your best bet to have their food is to buy this book and cook it yourself. And this is more than just a cookbook. It's the story of his life and food and the story of so much of the Jewish diaspora's experience as well. Like a traditional Israeli meal all about generosity and sharing, the book offers an abundance of mouthwatering recipes interwoven with personal stories, beautiful photos, historical context, and sidebars on ingredients that make up the unique cuisine of Israel. The book is deeply personal, deeply moving, and really deeply delicious. So Michael is joined in conversation tonight by that other Michael who would plunk Zahav in so the one and only Michael Bauer. Please join me to welcome Michael Solomonoff and Michael Bauer.
Hi.
Hello there.
Just an intimate conversation here.
Yes, really. How many of you have been to Zahav? So there are some of you. Great. I went in 2010, and I was there with the James Beard Restaurant Committee, and we meet in different cities, and we all go out and scatter and go to different restaurants. And I was really there as a critic. I didn't really know anything about Mike. I don't know anything about Israeli food. And I was totally captivated by what he was doing. Not just the flavors, which were great, but I felt something in the food that I feel very rarely. I know that people talk about, putting your soul and love in cooking, and it's used actually too much. But there was something there that I really did feel. You were giving us a part of yourself, and I knew nothing about him. And really didn't know that much until I started, reading about your background and how, cooking Israeli food and what you're doing really became your lifeline. And so, and it's all there in the food. And so I'm hoping that we can explore kind of your discovery of the food and what you're doing. But I think probably to start, since a lot of people have not been to Zahav and your other restaurants, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, so Zahav is, so people call Zahav a modern Israeli restaurant, and it's ironic. I mean, we cook meat on sticks over charcoal. You know, we cook bread to order in a wood-burning oven that's, like, super old, you know? So I think the idea of Israeli food becoming sort of globalized and looking at Israel as a whole, you know, not just like the shawarma or falafel that most people think is Israeli food, but looking at the Moroccan influences, the Yemeni influences, the Ethiopian, even exploring like my grandmother's cooking that's from Bulgaria, but touched by Ottoman, but Spanish before that, like, you know, from the 1600s. Like, bringing all that to one place is what makes it, I think, modern. Because even in Israel, you don't really see everything sort of together. And ironically, I mean, it all happens to be in, like, eastern Pennsylvania, too. So that's a small little piece of information that's sort of important.
There's so many influences that go into Israeli cooking. So how do you actually get your mind around it?
That's a great question. I mean, it really depends. Sometimes we start with an ingredient, you know, and pumpkin obviously is a big thing for the next 8 months for us. So we can start with pumpkin, or we can say, you know, I had maklouba last time I was there, which is like an inverted sort of rice, meat, eggplant situation. And like, how are we going to recreate that now? What do we have available? Or I was really taken by the spice blend that our spice guy let me sample, and like, how are we going to build a dish around that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of organic. I mean, we have to be a little bit deliberate because we're not in Israel, and because I don't have like Shabbat meals with families over there, we have to sort of, you know, reel in all this information. But that's generally how it works.
So how did you actually educate yourself?
I think just eating. I mean, every time I go back, even to this day, I'm in Israel probably around twice a year, and every single time I go, I'm trying to eat as much as possible, which my wife hates. I'm like, finish that up. We have another lunch in 20 minutes. But everybody knows, you know, that's kind of like my shtick a little bit. So every time I go over, there's always new things to try. And what is so amazing is that I, you know, think I know a little bit about cooking and I know a little bit about Israel, but every single time I go, I discover these new things. There's always new influences. They're always like, there's a little place in a shuk in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem that I haven't tried yet, or we get invited to, you know, a friend of a friend and have Shabbat dinner, and I find out what like Kurdish food is, or the difference between straight Iraqi Jewish and Kurdish cooking, or we go to the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem and eat something new. There's always these new things that we're trying to sort of recreate or express.
It's interesting because in Zahav you don't serve pork or shellfish, right?
Right.
Or you don't mix milk and meat.
Right.
And in the book you said that's kind of, to you, is Jewish cooking.
It is. I mean, that's what, you know, for a long time, and before we opened, we had to sort of, and even after we opened, identifying what was Israeli food was like a big challenge. You know, because people eat treif in Israel. But the things that have sort of characterized Israeli food for me, it's like the people all returning from wherever they were in the world, back to Israel. And the kashrut was a very easy way to sort of determine what it was that they ate or how they ate. So for us, it's not like putting like treif on the menu would necessarily be contradictory, but it just, you know, I don't want to like roast a piece of lamb and then serve it with tzatziki. I don't want to serve it with yogurt because it'd be very easy to fall into a different genre of cooking, because you could be Turkish, right, or you could be Greek, or you could be Syrian, or whatever. And for us, like, you know, speaking exactly to that, when I roast lamb and I think of Israeli food, I want tchina, you know. And a lot of people, I don't think, understand the importance of like pureed sesame on everything. and they should. It's actually in chapter one, the tchina chapter. But for us, that's a very easy way to identify Israeli cuisine and sort of tell a story. And so that was our idea. I mean, we eat plenty of treif.
Right. And do you practice that? Do you not eat shellfish and pork at home, or do you?
Oh no!
Just
so much shellfish and pork. I don't cook a lot in my house, but whenever, I don't know, we ate like bacon cheeseburgers last night on the road down here at 12:30 at night.
How was it as a chef not to include dairy and meat? Was that
really
difficult?
So difficult. And I think that I come from like European cooking, and specifically Northern Italian, where it's like pasta water, butter, pancetta, Parmesan cheese, butter, olive oil, Parmesan cheese, like so many different layers of cheese and meat that it is really challenging. And I think it's really, especially for, you know, I'm emotionally invested into what it is that we're doing, and it makes a lot of sense for me when a cook comes in and they're like, don't you want to rest this piece of meat in butter? You know, it's difficult. And even one of my sous chefs the other day, we were making like a pilaf that we were serving with grilled meat, and she was like about to grate kashkaval cheese on top. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. And she's like, oh, right, cheese and meat. So whenever we get in, you know, every now and then we'll have a special dinner, and like a farmer will bring by like pork or bacon, like all the cooks like gravitate towards the, everyone's like deprived, you know? So it is challenging, but it's really cool to be able to cook in the style of kashrut and to keep it real, you know, and to have it still be great. And whether our customers kind of know it or not, it's the way that we've been eating for thousands of years. So it's cool to continue that tradition. We are still open on Fridays and Saturdays, so it's not like, we're not that kosher. You know? You get people come in too. It's funny, you know, everybody's like, oh, I'm not kosher, but I don't eat pork. Like in my, growing up in Pittsburgh, we'd get 10 feet away from my house and it was like bacon or shrimp scampi. But in the house, we would never, ever, ever have pork. My dad, actually, that's not true. When we moved to Israel, my dad would like drive up to a kibbutz in the north that was like into the pork production, and he would like wrap up like bacon in like foil and like sneak it behind the orange juice and only let myself or my brother know, so my mom like wouldn't know. But we get people like that too that are like, you know, I'm sort of kosher, or they'll sit in like a corner of the restaurant, so if anybody else from the synagogue comes by and sees, they don't see them there. Or we make laffa and we serve it on foil, not on plates, or we bake fish in foil, and there's so many different sort of degrees of kashrut that we have to adapt.
So what percent of your customers are Jewish, do you think? I mean, I know it's
hard to say. I mean, I guess there's probably, as far as like the dining public in most major cities, I think that it's probably a large, you know, on the East Coast especially, I think that we have a lot of Jewish customers. But if we're not like, you know, we're not like, 50% of our customers aren't Jewish, I don't think. And everyone's like, oh, you must get a lot of Israelis. And I was like, well, half of them that like it, the other half that think I suck and that I'm not doing justice to all the food that they grew up with. So it's sort of, you know, around the holidays too, we will do like special Rosh Hashanah like meals, or for Pesach we'll do dinners. And I always joke because we get people that come in that like don't want to go to shul, but they come to Zahav and they're like, oh, that's okay, it's close enough. You know? And those are like, you know, those are families, and those are people with like real expectations of like what a holiday is. So it's like those are very touchy menus. You know, you have to be a little bit careful. But in general, I think that our clientele is every single person, every single age, every single sort of culture comes to Zahav.
Right. And in your progression in Israeli cooking, I mean, I remember in the book you say something about your kind of love-hate relationship with tahini, how you used to not like it.
Right. Well, it was...
And now it's everywhere.
Now it's everywhere in our book, and, you know, it's obviously an acquired taste, and that sort of roasted bitter as being like the mother sauce for everything that you have with meat is important, and it's relevant. And I grew up with, like, a very American, you know, we'd, like, watch, like, MASH reruns at the kitchen table. And it would be like sliced white bread, jar of tahina, you know, steak, rice, whatever, and then like baklava or whatever for dessert. So it was scattered and you know, it was kind of strange. And all the quality of tahina at that time sucked. It wasn't even good. We would get like the whatever generic, like Middle Eastern brand of tahina that could have sat on a shelf for 2.5 years before we ever picked it up. So the top was like the sesame oil slick, and the bottom was like silly putty, and you're supposed to spread that on Wonder Bread and eat it. It was totally gross. Not like the tahina recipe that we have in the book.
You know, when I went to Zahav in 2010, you were there in front of the oven,
yes,
doing the laffa, which I think you still do, right?
Yes,
that's kind of your place in the kitchen.
It's my home.
Why there?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, it's right in front of the bathroom. So if you have to go to the bathroom at Zahav, you pass through where, like, you come right in front of the pass where I am. So I get to basically see everybody. It has a... Not going to the bathroom. I mean, you know, it's a separate... It's not that... It's not, like, biblical like that. It's like, you know, we have bathrooms. And then it's the directly to the front door, so you can see every single person come into the restaurant, all of the hot food, and actually all of the cold food minus... Like, basically everything except for dessert passes by me. And it's the station where you make laffa, which is like an Iraqi sort of pita flatbread thing that accompanies our hummus. So I get to make hummus and laffa for, I mean, everybody comes to Zahav mostly for those two things, and they stick around for the rest of the food, but they come in basically for hummus and for laffa, and I get to physically, on the nights that I'm there, I get to make with my hands food for every single person, which sounds crazy because I'm a chef, but like, that's not really how it works. Usually when you're the chef of a big restaurant, you do a lot of like barking and bossing around or pointing and a lot of expediting, you know? You get to like play around with the tickets and make sure the food gets to the right tables. But to physically be able to make, you know, bread for everybody, I think is rare and sort of special. Plus, all of my kitchen employees get to see me get totally crushed on the bread station, gets super busy, so I get to go down like a ton of bricks. And it's very... It's good for morale, you know? They see the boss gets crushed too, so.
It's interesting. In the book, there's a quote that I love that said, that you said, the craft of cooking is about chasing perfection through repetition and ritual and never quite getting there. And I find it interesting because when I interviewed Thomas Keller here, what he loves about being a chef is a repetition. For him, it was fish. I talked to Nancy Oakes, and it's the same thing. So what is it about the repetition that seems to draw you in?
Well, I think that I've got, you know, we always strive for perfection, and you never hit perfect with food, right? And you can do things, except Thomas Keller. He's perfect. But he, no, I think that everybody knows. Like, we cook very simple food, but to get it perfect and to nail it every single time is almost impossible. And we use the example of rice, this humble pot of rice, you know, that I've cooked plenty of pots of rice before. My brother-in-law, who's sort of the inspiration for Persian rice, he's Iranian, and he's been cooking rice since he was like 9 years old or whatever, and he still shoots it out sometimes. He still burns it sometimes, and I just feel like you're always trying to, you know, meet and exceed expectations with our guests, but with ourselves as well, and I think there's something great about that. You know, it's frustrating at times too. I mean, there's no absolute with cooking. It's the most subjective thing in the world, and there's no perfect, and there's no science. But we're always striving to always sort of nail it.
At one point at Zahav, I know that you know it's very successful now. But there was a time that you talk about when you almost had to turn the lights out,
yeah,
because it wasn't successful. So what motivated you to continue?
Well, I mean, our Steve and our homes were collateralized for the loan, so we had to continue. We wanted to continue because we didn't want to, you know, get everything sort of taken away. And we were invested, obviously, emotionally into what it was that we were doing. I think what turned it around was the idea that we didn't have to just reproduce dishes from Israel. Because that's what, when we opened, that's what we thought we would do. We'd have the main dining room, and we'd cook shakshuka or chreme or, you know, make, like, cucumber tomato salad, which is all good, except for, like, February in Pennsylvania is not a time to be chopping tomatoes and cucumbers. You know, it doesn't make sense. And we had another little offshoot that was more of, like, a fancy, like, tasting menu thing that I thought would be stimulating for me as a chef. But the reality is, you know, our take on Israeli food, our idea of what Israeli cuisine is, our frame of reference is what is so important. So it took us almost closing. It was a conversation I had with Steve, and he was like, dude, you got to just, like, cook food. You got to just be a chef. You got to, like, make food. You know, stop just, like, reproducing this stuff. Like, get people excited about it, you know? And that's kind of what did it. We really understood what our role was. We understood what our, you know, sort of identity was in Philadelphia, representing Israel, and also we, you know, it 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 wasn't working for our customers. They didn't care whether it was, you know, my grandmother's recipe or not. They just wanted, they wanted a good meal. They wanted to be, you know, stimulated. So we did a lot. We like got rid of half of our staff. We, you know, I like borrowed money from my dad to make payroll. I mean, you make a lot of decisions, important decisions, when you're about to like die, you know. And I think we kind of needed that to happen. And it's also important for us moving forward. You know, we don't ever really take for granted our success, because you know, it can go away very quickly.
Right.
You're listening to Chef Michael Solomonoff, whose new book is Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. He's joined in conversation by Michael Bauer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, you also reformatted the menu, right? You changed a lot.
We did, actually. It was so funny. We had to participate in Restaurant Week, and for a long time that was sort of taboo. If you get involved in Restaurant Week, it means you suck. And we, you know, but we had to do it because our restaurant was dying, and it allowed us to format the menu the way, because we had to come up with like a way for people to order. And when we first opened, our menu was like this big. There were no descriptions in English about the food. So you'd have like a foretop come in and say, what's the malawach? And our server, who more than likely wasn't Israeli or even knew how to pronounce it, would have to sit at the table and explain what a Yemenite laminated flatbread is, or all these different words in Hebrew, which like is a terrible idea, you know? We have like, you know, nobody can pronounce our restaurant that well. It's not on a ground floor. And when you've got those strikes against you, you do not open a restaurant with a menu that doesn't like have English on it. So we had to listen to our customers and like sort of participate in that. And Restaurant Week was like funny because that's the format that we use now. Mm-hmm. And we still participate in Restaurant Week too. So next time you guys are in Philly,
you know, as I was reading about you, I was fascinated by kind of your background, the process of being raised in the United States, going back to Israel, then kind of the back and forth, and kind of how you rediscovered your Israeli roots. So can you describe a little bit about that journey, kind of how you went from cooking Italian and a little bit about the background there?
Yeah, so I was born in Israel. I grew up in Pittsburgh and then moved back to Israel when I was 15. My family decided to make Aliyah, and we all moved back. And it was my dad, who's Bulgarian but basically Israeli, my mom, who's American, and my younger brother, who's born in the States. So we all moved back. I stay for 1 year at a boarding school and then come back to Pittsburgh, finish high school, try to go to college, fail at that, move back out to Israel, and I started cooking there, basically. And that was kind of where I needed a job. I wasn't, like, into food. I just needed to, like, work. And, you know, my Hebrew was terrible, and I was, like, a photography major, so I was basically without skills in Israel. So I got a job, you know, scrubbing sheet trays at a bakery, and then, you know, and then, like, loved it, right? And so I moved back to the States and went to culinary school in Florida, and then ended up in Philly, kind of like on the way to New York, because I wanted to cook in a big city. Philly was sort of reasonable, and the girl that I moved up there with had a brother or something there. So we ended up there, and I cooked at a restaurant called Stroy Bass, which was sort of like the Le Bernardin or the Farallon. Right? Like a bit like the Farallon restaurant, sort of like that. It was a big sort of fancy fish sort of French restaurant. And then I worked at a little restaurant called Vetri, which is a Northern Italian restaurant. At the time, it was the only, Mark Vetri's only restaurant. It was 30 seats. It was like myself, two other people, and Mark cooking every night. And I hadn't been back to Israel in almost 4 years, and I ended up going back to Israel to visit my family, and it was the first time I'd really been into cooking. And my brother, who was younger, was finishing up his military service in the IDF. He was on this break before you finish your offer, about a month. So he and I got to hang out for like 3 weeks, and we traveled up and down the country, and we ate food, and we'd like go into the Yemenite soup place and try to figure out what it is that they were doing. And, you know, we hadn't seen each other in 4 years, basically. So it was very, very meaningful. I came back to Vetri, and we were closed on Yom Kippur, and I was driving my dad's old car from Pittsburgh to Philly, and I found out on that trip that my brother was killed. He was patrolling the northern border in Israel by like Matula, the Lebanese border, and was killed by Hezbollah snipers that were over the border. And, you know, I guess it's a bit more clear now, but at the time I was just like, I mean, obviously in shock, and it was extremely difficult. But I came back from his funeral, and I wasn't really that interested in cooking. I wasn't going to go to like Italy after that and stage. I was interested maybe in Spain or France, but all that became less important to me. And it was, you know, it was a big deal, obviously. I mean, I was kind of Israeli. I mean, I have an Israeli passport. You know, there were these like little things that were in my life, but it was obviously that was a really monumental sort of circumstance. And I got a job after Vetri cooking at a restaurant called Marigold Kitchen, which was owned and run by Steve, who's my partner now. His wife and I grew up together in Pittsburgh. Actually, my mom was her teacher at a Solomon Schechter school, ironically enough. And Steve wanted to get out of the kitchen, and he hired me to be the chef. And I didn't want to go to New York. I didn't want to go to Spain. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't really want to leave, but I didn't really know what to do. And Steve said I could be the chef of this 30-seat BYOB in West Philly. So I jumped on that, and we started experimenting with Israeli food. And it wasn't like hummus or salatim or anything like that. It would be like, you know, pink lentil soup, like a pure, like a veloute of pink lentils with lamb kebab wrapped in cabbage, you know? And that was actually the first dish that sort of like, that was the light bulb dish. We had this soup on the menu. I made this soup that had like lobster broth and coconut milk, and then I made like a coconut panna cotta, you know, and you'd pour the soup over and it would like melt. But really, like, it was just serving like medium temperature soup. Like, nobody liked it, you know, because it was like hot and cold. I thought it was brilliant. And everyone was like, the soup is lukewarm. And I'm like, yes, aha, that's it, you know. So we found out, at that time, Steve was like, you know, amongst everything else, was also like the receptionist at the restaurant. So he got a call and he was like, I think that our food critic, Craig LeBan, just made a reservation. And he was like, and we got to talk about that soup. It totally sucks. Like, nobody likes it. And, you know, I went to like the Middle Eastern market. I got pink lentils. We made lamb kebab, which is a very, like the way that we did it was very Bulgarian, like where my, you know, my family's from. We add like a little bit of sugar to it and baking soda so it puffs. And we made this lamb kebab wrapped with cabbage with the pink lentil soup. And our food critic came in and ate everything and then wrote about that soup and said it was like Jerusalem in a bowl. And I was like, aha, there it is, you know? So after that moment, I mean, there were a few other things that sort of happened, but we were confident and comfortable. And for me, it was super cool to cook Israeli food and to, you know, I wasn't trying, at the time, I wasn't like, this is going to bring me closer to my brother. But it, as it sort of played out, I mean, it's really awesome to be able to cook Israeli food, to represent Israel, you know, to make your family proud or whatever, and to be part of this sort of heritage and to do it in a way that isn't, you know, me arguing about politics or, right. You know, for a while I was like, I'm going to go join the military and I would have sucked at that. So this is, it's cool, you know, we get to talk about Israel and we get to talk about the Israeli people and what makes up Israel and to do it through food. And
you don't have to talk about the politics.
Thank God. People still try, but yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because you say politics and I'm like, most of the arguments in Israel are about people like discussing what the best hummus is and where to go, you know? And coming over to the pass at Zahav and telling me I don't make like carrots the way their like mother made it, or that's like the big discussion. So those are good arguments, you know?
It was interesting when you were talking about, did you say that after your brother died, you didn't feel like cooking?
I didn't. It wasn't that I didn't feel like cooking. It was that I just was like, without meaning, you know? I wasn't... I didn't want to be where I was. You know, I grew up my entire life basically American, you know? And there were, like, as I said, there were, like, little things, having, like, tequila on the table, or, like, you know, whenever there'd be conflict in the news, we'd all get quiet, you know, so, like, my parents could watch or whatever and explain to us what was happening. There wasn't tons of, like, Israeli stuff happening. When you have a sibling that dies, you know, in the military, specifically the way that my brother did, it you know, sort of changes things very quickly for you, and it did for me, and I just didn't, you know, I didn't care that much about Italian food after that, I guess. I mean, I love Italian food, but I just didn't, it wasn't what I was going to do.
So it was Italian food you weren't interested in. You became more interested in the Israeli food as a way of being closer to your brother or his memory.
That's the way that it has sort of panned out. It wasn't that deliberate at the time. I wasn't, right, like, cognizant of what was happening.
Right. You also talked about, and I think this is in the book, about, and then I read the Frank Bruni article about... you know, your struggle with drugs and all of that. And,
yes.
And you said, my tendencies towards addiction reared its head right after I returned from the funeral.
Yes.
So what happened to you? What was your life like prior to that and then after that? And
well, very different. before that, you know, I mean, I just cooked all the time. I worked all the time. And I was very focused on, you know, my career. And after that, I was focused on my career, but I was sort of living this double life, and I was in the throes of active drug addiction. And it was very, you know, I've always had, you know, not to get into too much detail, I've always been a pretty crazy kid, and I've always been a very compulsive person. And I guess, you know, I'm in recovery, I'm a recovering drug addict. And I, you know, as I deal with this longer, I'm like, well, I've always had these tendencies. The problem is when you have those tendencies and then you have something as traumatic as, like, your younger brother getting, like, killed by snipers over international border on Yom Kippur, it's, like, so, you know, it's just sort of obvious what you're going to do after that. And for better or for worse, I was very, very good at lying to, like, every single person close to me. So, on the outside, we're winning awards, we're opening restaurants, I'm meeting, you know, business partners and friends. I met my wife, got married, all of it in active drug addiction that I was, like, basically hiding from everybody. I never got arrested, which is nice. I should have been many, many times. And that might have arguably stopped what it was that was happening. But it was a very difficult, you know, 5 years or whatever. And it obviously got worse. And then we opened an Israeli restaurant, like, right at the beginning of the recession. With me as, like, you know, the chef partner. I mean,
so crazy. was it worse after you opened Zahav?
It got, I mean, it's a progressive disease, so I think, right, it always gets worse. It never gets better.
And so what was your kind of epiphany moment? What brought you out of that?
My epiphany moment was my business partner, Steve, who's here, and my wife and another good friend of mine, like, having an intervention and basically taking me to, like, drug rehab. And then, after that, after getting out of rehab, and after my wife finding out that her husband of 2 years was, you know, a drug addict, and my business partner of years also finding out that, like, you know, we were invested, everything we had was invested together, that I was a drug addict, that, you know, my wife would pick me up from the restaurant every single night and drive me home. My business partner, Steve, would pick me up every single morning at a 12-step meeting that I attended and drive me into work. And, you know, listen to me freak out and be, you know, in recovery. And all, you know, it was a combined effort, basically. But having all these people in your corner that, you know, love you, that are trying to get you better, I think, was the key to it.
And cooking, obviously, was kind of a lifeline for you during that.
Well, it's so funny that you say that. You know, everybody in rehab, all the counselors were like, well, you're supposed to not make any major changes your first year of recovery, but they're also like, you should not be in the restaurant business either. And you're like, well, I'm in the restaurant business. Yeah. And so a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of pretty crazy people in restaurants, but I find that there's crazy drug addicts everywhere in the world, in society. I think that it was incredibly difficult, but there is we needed the restaurant to get better, you know, and like the restaurant needed me to get better, and those are, things were happening sort of side by side. And I think that, you know, you learn a lot about yourself when you put it all out on the table for everybody. And, you know, our kitchen staff, you know, I spend more time with our dishwashers than I do with like my wife and my kids to, you know, put things in perspective. So, you know, I was embraced, and I think that it was time for me to really sort of step up to the plate a little bit. And I'd let a lot of people down. So it was a good thing. Cooking is a great thing. I mean, I didn't think for the first year that I would be able to be a great chef without being a drug addict. And I know that sounds crazy, but your mind has really messed up things to you when you're sort of in active addiction. And the truth is, we have a much better restaurant without the chef being addicted to drugs, surprisingly enough. So it really, you know, cooking has gotten me through everything. And my partnership with Steve has gotten me through just about everything, too. And you know, my wife and everybody else has been very supportive, but we lean on each other, you know, through the good times and the bad times, and that was crucial.
It's interesting that that you, you know, found cooking and the Jewish cooking. Has that had any effect on your religion and your religious beliefs? Or?
No, I mean, I think that, for me, Judaism, well, my religion and my faith change all the time, every minute, depending on what kind of service we're having at Zahav, how much you have to pray for things to go well. But I, you know, I'm Jewish, and it's part of my identity, and being Israeli is also part of my identity, and it wasn't like the conventional way that got me to where I am. I think this is sort of part of it, and I think that this has definitely gotten me back to Israel and back to Judaism. I don't know, you know, if my belief in like God or a higher power has necessarily changed, but my identity, my Jewish identity, is definitely strengthened.
Mm-hmm. Although you've become very known, obviously, for your Jewish food, I think that you also have Percy Street, which is barbecue,
yes,
and also Federal Donuts, which is donuts and chicken.
Also so. Very Jewish, yeah. I know. Well, I don't know. We were discussing this, Steve and I. Everyone always asks about the barbecue restaurant, and I'm like, Texas style is just about Jewish brisket, right? It's like smoked brisket. So, you know, and Federal Donuts, too, is super random. I don't know actually even how that happened, but here we are. But sort of moving forward, I mean, I think that we love to eat and cook sort of everything. I think that what has worked for us, being emotionally invested into what it is that you do, helps out a lot, you know. And with Abe Fisher, which is more of like Steve's background, and our chef Yehuda, who grew up in a very religious, sort of like American Jewish household, you know, returning to go visit Hungary and to go eat like Jewish food in Hungary that's been the same forever is, you know, meaningful, right? To go to Israel and to visit all these places and to cook food that like my people have been cooking for thousands of years, or to make the, you know, boreka dough that my family had brought from like the Inquisition to Israel and that is now this like Israeli breakfast food, you know, is the most meaningful thing for me. And it's much easier to do things that are meaningful 80 hours a week when you, like, love them, when it's, like, part of who you are. So that's not to say that, like, Korean chicken and donuts are not incredible. And also can be spiritual, depending on how frequently you eat them. But, you know, for us, I think that, you know, Zahav's like my baby, and this is our, this is sort of part of it.
But how did, like, Federal Donuts happen? It's so different.
So Federal Donuts happened because we opened Zahav, and we almost failed. And then we decided that we were going to open Percy Street Barbecue, and we were obsessed with, you know, at Zahav we cook everything over charcoal and the bread in the wood-burning oven, and, you know, smoking meat is awesome. Smoked brisket is amazing. It's something that we can obviously relate to. We like pastrami. We like brisket, right? So we opened this barbecue restaurant. Our partner there is from the South. And it was like a really tough opening. You know, we opened this big restaurant. We thought that barbecue would be low tech, which it isn't. We thought that everybody would love it, which they don't. We thought that it would be super cheap, which it's not. And, you know, we made a lot of mistakes. And then we were, like, bored, you know, because we had these two big restaurants that were sort of, like, squeaking by.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Chef Michael Solomonoff, whose new book is Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. He's joined in conversation by Michael Bauer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And we became very good friends with these guys that brought Stumptown to Philly, and they had this little coffee shop, and they wanted to open a donut shop. And another one of our friends that was a food writer somehow made it in the conversation. So it was five of us, and we said, well, let's do coffee and we'll do donuts. Nobody's really doing donuts that well in Philly. And I think that at the time, we were just frequenting this Korean fried chicken place in North Philly. And we thought, well, if we're frying donuts, we might as well fry chicken, you know? And it turns out the donuts taste awful after you fried chicken in the fryer. But the chicken tastes great with donut batter in it. So we have separate pieces of equipment now. But we opened it, and the first day that we opened, it was like me and Steve making... you know, donuts and chicken at like 2 a.m. and scrubbing like quart containers, you know, because we didn't have like a dishwasher. And then everybody sort of pitched in. We each put in very little money and got like 600 square foot little space to make it. And we ran out of donuts the first day. We opened at 7. We were out by 9. The first few days, because we cure the chicken overnight, so it's a process, we had so many people in line that we couldn't actually sell chicken. We just had to cut chicken into like pieces and give it to people. And I like told dirty jokes while people waited in line. And luckily they came back and they didn't sue me. And we knew that we were sort of onto something. And now we've got four permanent like brick and mortar Federal Donuts in Philly. We've got one outpost in the Phillies stadium. Ironically, they've totally sucked since we've opened there. The Phillies have done terribly. And we've got one, we did like a little pop-up where we did like fried chicken sandwiches. And so hopefully we'll open a couple of those too.
And then you have the hummus shop, which...
Right, exactly. So in Israel, there is a thing called a hummusia, which is just what it sounds like. It's a place where, you know, the owner boils a bunch of chickpeas and then he makes hummus. And then when he sells out, you leave. And that's it. So we thought that with the popularity of hummus in general, but also with, you know, Zahav, people really embraced it. We thought, why not just do like a hummus place? We can make fresh hummus with a couple different varieties that sort of change. Our chef there, Emily, is really connected with the local farms. So she just gets like whatever shipped in. She turns it into hummus toppings. We make pita fresh every day. And the reality is it's only slightly more expensive than like terrible fast food. So it's awesome. You can eat it all the time. It's not very expensive. You don't feel like terrible about yourself. Like I did last night at 12:30 at night on the way down here, crying in the rearview mirror, eating a bacon cheeseburger. And people embrace it and they love it. And it's, again, it's an extension of what we do. I mean, it's something that you see, it's like in popular culture in Israel. Taxi cab drivers, soldiers, doctors, lawyers, criminals, cops, everybody eats hummus. Maybe at different times in the day, but everybody eats hummus. So, and people are embracing it here too.
Well, that you're going to do in New York, right?
That
style.
We read that this morning. I guess we're opening a hummus place in New York. We read that on Eater.
But it was true.
I guess. Is it? I don't know. So, yeah, I think we could probably do some of those. We don't want to open any more Zahavs unless we're opening it right down the street. Unless we have a business partner here in San Francisco.
Yeah. Not me, but I'm sure we could find you some. Right. Probably some out here who could help you.
Yeah, I'm like, you know what this JCC could use? A Zahav, right?
Actually, they had a restaurant here.
I'm sure
for a while.
Tomorrow, like Eater San Francisco, Zahav's opening at the JCC. I know. So if we open one here, we'll open it at the right in the spot. But we, thank you. We love the restaurants, but Zahav is a really difficult one to reproduce, and like I like to be there. We don't want to have to, you know. But we've had plenty of opportunity to open Zahav in different places, but it's sort of special where it is.
So no Las Vegas.
No Las Vegas. Not at all.
You know, one of the things, because you do obviously an interpretation, so you are coming up with new things.
Yeah.
But you said in the book that one of the side effects of the culture is the unquenchable thirst for what is new.
Yes.
So how do you balance that tradition with satisfying the pressure you as a chef are under to always be creating something new?
Well, it's funny. There are like two things happening with cooking in restaurants. There's like the molecular, and then there's like the sort of stripping things down and going rustic, right? And for us, you know, we're basing this on there's like over 100 different cultures that make up Israel, but like probably at least 30 of them that are very prominent in day-to-day food. So for me, the new is going to like these little places and tasting something that I have never had or ever heard of that's been around for like 2,000 years. And then it's how to make it relevant. Fermentation seems to be a cool thing that's happening right now among chefs. That's fine. We've been pickling, you know, forever. So it's like about sort of delivering that to our guests and bringing it into our kitchen and making it, you know, cool and exciting and keeping up with what's happening around Zahav, like the farmers and the you know, estuaries and all that stuff, and what's happening with the globalization of Israeli food, plus the immigration still to Israel, because now there's all, you know, there's like Ethiopians, tons of them in Israel, that have just started immigrating in the last 10 years. So I gotta figure out teff. Clearly, I got all this new stuff. So I think it's really about sort of acquiring and learning about these old traditions, and then making them applicable.
How often do you go back to Israel?
Twice a year, around. It depends. We led a culinary tour. We've led a few of them, actually. We led a culinary tour in July. I was back in September for a second. We're probably going to go in the spring to visit, you know, and eat a little bit. And then we'll probably go again. I'll bring my family maybe in the summer. So.
And have your children been there? Excuse me. Have they been there?
My children?
To Israel, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really long plane ride, and but we've got a 4-year-old and a 15-month-old, and the 4-year-old has been there maybe 5 times.
Wow.
And the 15-month-old has been there 3 times. Yeah, and it is expensive. Good Lord.
Do you ever see moving back there for a period of time?
You know, what I thought we were going to do was open Zahav and do really well, and then go open like a boutique hotel in Israel and get the first Michelin star. There's no Michelin rating system yet in Israel. And then I got clean and sober. And no, I'm just kidding. But then I don't know. It's really hard to do business in different markets, and it would be really difficult to open in a different country. I think that a donut and chicken shop in Tel Aviv would be the coolest thing in the world. But it's important for me to be there, and it's important for my family. Like, I want my kids to have not just like American Jewish identity, but understand Israel a little bit. So I'd like to spend summers there at some point, whether it happens or not anytime soon. While my kids are still young, we'll see.
Let's talk a little bit about cooking.
Yes.
You were talking about, it was really interesting in the book, there are all kinds of great tips and things I learned. You know, like adding baking soda to the
to the chickpeas, yes.
To the chickpeas. And also to the kebabs or things to help lighten them.
Yes.
And in the twice-cooked eggplant, you talked about charring the slices.
Yes.
Which is amazing how char is becoming the the big trend these days. Everyone's charring and burning.
They're charring and burning, and like 10 years ago, all of our chefs would have made us throw all of that stuff out and start again. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's great to do things that are totally contrary to what people have taught you.
And how did you come up with that technique with the eggplant?
I watched somebody cook, and I was like, whoa, you're absolutely burning that. And they're like, yeah, it's cool. In Israel, there's a kebab shop right by our house in Kfar Saba, and it's just like a normal, it's just a place where families go, right, to eat. It's like layman food. And there was a menu item that translates directly to fried and pickled eggplant. And I was like, that sounds disgusting and delicious. I have to know what it is, you know? And you take eggplant and you burn it, basically, and then you put an ungodly amount of vinegar on top of it and cook it out. And the result is not bitter. It is smoky and sweet. It's almost chocolatey and rich. It's just so, so good. And the idea that you would do something that all of these like European chefs that I've worked for many years would freak out on me about, and then serve it and have people that don't normally like eggplant love it, is like the ultimate win. And that's, you know, again, it's like you're working with so many different cultures. Everybody, all these techniques that have stood the test of time. Like,
yeah, how do you keep them all separate? Because each culture does have a different technique.
Well,
under the umbrella of Israeli cooking.
The luxury of having an Israeli restaurant that's not in Israel is that you can look at all of it and say, I want to do that, or I want to do this, or, you know, I've seen baba ganoush made in Israel. That's like eggplant. You roast it, and then you mix it with tchina. Well, we don't have eggplant right now. We live in, like, eastern Pennsylvania. We've got pumpkin, so let's char pumpkin over charcoal, and let's make pumpkin baba ganoush, or let's make Brussels sprout baba ganoush, because that would be the perfect way to do the twice-cooked thing. You know, that's actually it. You talk about being current or not, right? Everybody's doing lamb three ways. But the original lamb two ways is like fried kibbeh. Have you guys had kibbeh before? Right? So it's lamb and bulgur wheat, and you make a crust, like a shell with this raw lamb, and then you stuff it with cooked lamb, and you deep fry it, and it's like fantastic, right? So the Lebanese and the Syrian Jews from Aleppo have been making lamb two ways forever, right? So why not, like, take Brussels sprouts, which you don't find in Israel, and turn that into something Israeli and make it cool and exciting and utilize waste, which is also trendy, and burn charcoal, you know, like Brussels sprouts, and use it to sauce something that you would never have in Israel, but make it taste purely Israeli. That's what's so exciting.
But you, when you talk about the machine that you had invented or had done to make the crust.
Yes.
But that broke, right? So you don't make it anymore?
We make it using our hands, which everybody hates. We have to get another machine.
Talk about that. That was really
machine.
Cool.
So we run into this little place in Nazareth called Al-Janin, and we had all these kibbehs that were fantastic, and they looked perfect. And we were like, how do you make this? Because normally what you do is you take this ball of shell, and you like fit it around the thumb, and you like, which is cool if you don't have anything to do for like 3 hours, you know? I was like, man, how do you make these so perfect? And the guy's like, come check this out. And he had a meat grinder that they sort of like had this metal dowel fabricated to it. So when you crank out the shell, you like insert the shell and you crank it out, and this tube of kibbeh shell comes out, and you can like stuff it and finish it. And we bought it. You know what? We asked them, we're like, where do we get these? And they were like, well, you can buy the grinder here. And they literally just put it on our bill. And then we had to go back. It was the craziest thing. We took it back to Philly, and we had like a metal worker fix it for us. Just like totally insane. But it saves a lot of time.
That's great. I'm not here to publicize the book, but I will say it is a wonderful book.
Thank you.
You know, I read it, and they're one, the way it weaves your story and kind of your Jewish identity into it, and also the tips, I mean, about pouring the boiling water over the chicken to poach it rather than actually cooking it.
Yes.
There are just all kinds of little tips that I learned a lot about.
Well, thank you so much.
That's great. Yeah. So let's take some questions from the audience.
Yes. Is there a difference between Israeli food and Palestinian food?
There is, actually, and we discussed that a bunch. So Israeli food, people have been asking me that a bunch, obviously. Israeli food, is the way that I interpret it, is all the food that is currently being cooked in Israel, right? So 20% of the population in Israel is Arab. Like I was saying, my grandmother is from Bulgaria, but from Spain, so she makes borekas, which are definitely not Palestinian. North African cuisine that made it to Israel in the 50s, again, is also not like Palestinian. And, you know, I think that it's just such a small country with so many different influences. You've got this sort of mix and match and this sort of melting pot of so many things. Although Palestinian food is an important part of Israeli cooking, it's not, I don't think they're like the same.
Thank you. You mentioned that in rehab you were advised not to work in a restaurant. And and I was just wondering, what was the correlation?
I'm sorry, my advice to not work in the restaurant? I think that the advice was to not work in a restaurant was because restaurants are a little bit crazy, and I think that, like, a little bit unstable, to say the least.
Slightly violent. It's very stressful, right? And it's long hours.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of alcohol and things in restaurants.
There is. I mean, things happen at night, and we're sort of prone to, like, high pressure. And I think that sometimes that can be a little bit complicated when navigating sensitivity, you know? I'm, like, trying to speak as general as I can. I mean, restaurants are insane. It's, like, weird, though, because, you know, I don't want to give restaurants a bad rap, too. I mean, it's about the individual, right? I mean, most places of work don't involve people drinking booze all the time. A lot of people think, and I think it's getting a bit more sort of dated, that because you work in a restaurant, it's okay to, like, drink during service, when we don't do that at all, you know? So I think that recovery, and I think that restaurants are just sort of growing. All these, like, old sort of cliches and weird taboos are sort of changing.
Although there is a lot of adrenaline at the end of the shift because you've been working, and so you have to figure out ways to channel that adrenaline.
Yeah, we do Fight Club in the back by the dumpster. Well, everyone's like, what do you do after work? Because you don't drink. I'm like, I drink chamomile tea, eat cereal, and I watch horror movies for an hour and a half every night.
And on that, I think we'll conclude.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Chef Michael Solomonoff, whose new book is Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. He was joined in conversation by Michael Bauer, executive food and wine editor and restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.